By the time Adam was 130 years old, he had fathered numerous children. It is a little hard for us to conceive of people at such ages begetting children. But the world was a much different place in the years between creation and the great flood than it is now. Long lifespans and evidently long fertility spans made it certain that the command of God that was given to Adam and Eve when they were created would be fulfilled. And that command was that they were to replenish the earth. They were to fill the earth. And certainly in their lifetimes, they saw that come to pass. We tend to judge everything by our own experience. And so we find it difficult to believe that at the age of 130, Adam and Eve produced the son that they called Seth. When I think that the third wife of my great-grandfather gave birth to her last child, and that child is still living, when my great-grandfather was 70 years old, I find myself wondering what that situation would be like. Most people shudder to think of such a scenario when they reach their 40s or 50s to have a newborn child to look after. But obviously, the lives of our first parents and of those who came after them were much different than any experience we have known. And yet, I say that, and at the same time, there were a lot of similarities. They had families. They dealt, no doubt, with the same circumstances in terms of family relationships that we deal with, only on a much larger scale. Those people lived for centuries. And no doubt, during much of that time, they were able to produce children. But it was one particular birth to which the Spirit of God draws our attention in our text this evening, and that was the birth of Seth. That birth signaled to our first parents that the promises of the Creator were sure, and that there was every reason for them to be optimistic about the future, even though the world was already plunging into the depths of wickedness and despair. The birth of Seth meant that there was going to be preserved in the world a group of people who would adhere to the right way and who would cherish the proclamation, the preaching, if you will, of gospel truth. Now let that encourage us all this evening. The way of Cain, that appeared to be so powerful, would not carry the day. That was part of the message in the birth of Seth. Seth would prove to be, in the providence of God, the progenitor of a line of faithful people who would value highly that which Adam preached. And it should also impress us in that connection that the long lifespans of which we read in chapter 5 of Genesis, and to that chapter we will come in due course, that those long lifespans meant that multiple generations would be contemporaneous with each other. And so, Adam would still have been alive when Enoch was translated. And he would still have been alive when Lamech, the father of Noah, was born. You can work that out for yourself. I was looking at those figures this afternoon. Lamech was 8 generations from Adam. So that when Lamech was born, and I'm not going to try to string together all the greats that you would have to put in front of grandfather to get 8 generations, but Adam was still alive when the 8th generation from his line was born. So Adam was still alive. And this is another impressive thought. Less than 750 years before the Great Flood. That is more than half of the world's history between creation and the Great Flood was occupied by the life of Adam. More than half of that period. By the time that Adam and his wife were 130, and they never had, either of them, any birthdays, but by the time they were 130, the rottenness of sin's legacy had already made itself very apparent. Violence had crept across the face of the world like a cancer, and the accompanying perversions removed any last vestiges of the paradise that the world had been when it was newly made. But in Seth, and in the lives of those who followed him in succeeding generations, Adam and Eve could see that there would be preserved a godly remnant in the world. The words of verse 26 suggest that in the days of Seth's son, named Enos, there was the widespread establishment of true religious worship. In those days, men began to call upon the name of the Lord. Not suggesting, I don't believe, that there had never been anyone calling on the name of the Lord until that time. We know that that was not the case. But suggesting that now there was being established in a more corporate fashion a true religious worship. The efforts by the devil to pervert any and all religious worship did not succeed in obliterating true worship from the world. There were still some who recognized what it meant to call on the name of the Lord. They understood the gospel message, that the only way of approach to God was on the ground of shed blood. Now, I think we can be sure that the bulk of Adam's descendants rejected such a message and mocked the descendants of Seth for adhering to it. Cain had marked out his own way, and his descendants, as we have already seen, descended one generation after the next, inexorably into the swamp of immorality and violence. Surely Adam and Eve must have been shocked at those developments. These were people from their family. Their souls must have been grieved. But God's grace would not allow them to give up their trust in the word of the promise. So it was that God blessed them with yet another son. And they recognized this blessing from the Lord. They saw this little boy, whom they called Seth, as a replacement, an appointment for Abel. And so they gave him the name that means appointed one, Seth. And And from Seth, as we read in verse 26 and then in chapter 5, there would come a family of men and women who would take their stand for the Word of God in a world filled with spite and contempt for anything that was decent. And as we see this story unfold, ultimately we're going to come to chapter 6 and the beginning of the chapters that deal with the great flood. We're going to see how the diabolical march of perversion had infected almost everything. But in the face of that, there were still those who took their stand for that which was right, who took their stand on the platform of grace. What was the Creator showing in the birth of Seth? He was showing that the devil's handiwork, as powerful as it was, would not prevail. And that the promised deliverer would appear. So in these two verses, we come to describe godliness in the midst of degeneracy. Godliness in the midst of degeneracy. When you consider the world in which you live, you may be inclined to wonder if there is any way back. You may wonder if there will ever be any kind of true spiritual awakening again. You can read the stories of the past. You can read the stories of what happened in New England in the late 1730s and early 1740s. The move of God's Spirit that has come to be known in history as the Great Awakening. And you can read those stories, read the accounts that Jonathan Edwards wrote. For there were people in his time that doubted the genuineness of this move of God. He wrote stories about the remarkable nature of the conversions that took place during that time. You can be amazed at the numbers of people who were suddenly turned to faith in Christ. Without the high-powered evangelistic methodology that was coined in the 20th century. Suddenly, people's souls were awakened. And you can read those accounts and you can wonder if such scenes will ever be witnessed again. And yet, if you were to read Edwards' description of the spiritual condition of the land before that move of God, you would find a lot of similarities to what we find today. Let us remember that God has never abandoned His cause. We're coming next week to the beginning of our Reformation Month series. I always love to come to that time of the year when we remember what God did and when we rededicate ourselves, as it were, to the maintaining of that godly legacy, that godly heritage. God has not given up. And even now, with the forces of degeneracy on the march, and confident of final victory, God has preserved the descendants of the godly Seth in this world. They trace their lineage back to Noah and through him to his ancestor, Seth. They are here in this meeting tonight. They are in many places around the world taking their stand for what has been called the persecuted truth. When we look at our text this evening, we need to notice three actions that Adam and Eve were performing. Number one, reclaiming hope. The language at the beginning of verse 25 does not suggest that Adam and Eve had no other children during their first 130 years except for Cain and Abel. That would have been a very unusual thing, I think you can agree. As we have already pointed out, Cain had to have married one of his sisters. And many believe that Abel was also married again to one of his sisters before his death. Obviously, Adam and Eve had numerous other children then during the first century of life in this world. But there can be no doubt that the murder of Abel and the subsequent banishment of Cain were heavy blows to Adam and Eve. It would seem from this language that for a time at least, they gave up the thought of having any other children. If they would have reasoned the same thing would happen again, and that there would be more murders and more banishments, it would appear that for a time anyway, they gave up that idea. Perhaps they could not envision adding any more people to the increasing corruption that they could see all around them. But the Creator would not allow them to settle down, to collapse in the pit of despair. So He rekindled their desires for each other, and He rekindled their confidence in the promises that He had made to them. And they came together again, and Eve conceived and brought another son into the world. In this series of events, Adam and Eve were rising from the place of despair to reclaim their hope and their confidence in all that God had said. Yes, Abel had been murdered. Yes, Cain had been banished, and his descendants were filling the world with perversion. But Adam and Eve were now reclaiming their hope. They remind us of the statements of the Apostle Paul that our God is associated with hope and not with despair. If you turn to the New Testament, we'll look at one such reference in Romans chapter 15. Romans chapter 15. And verse 13. One of the great benedictions that we find in Romans, now the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace and believing, that ye may abound in hope through the power of the Holy Ghost. The power of the Holy Ghost is what stirs the people of God to hope and to confidence. To that solid confidence, that great expectation that God is going to be true to His Word. You can read elsewhere in Romans about this hope. You could go back to chapter 8 and read a number of references there to hope. God is the author of hope. And He is the sustainer of it as well. It is easy to give in to despair. It's easy to do it. It's easy to allow depression to overwhelm you. It's easy to wonder why God has led you in a certain way. Why God has brought certain things into your life. It's easy to go down that road. The devil wants you to go down that road. The great challenge of Christian living is hope. It is optimism. It is looking forward in the security that God has not lost control of His creation. That's the great challenge. It's easy to despair. It's easy to surrender to pessimism. The challenge is to live in hope. God's purposes are ripening fast, and they will be fulfilled. In this act Adam and Eve, 130 years after the creation, were taking back the hope that shone so brightly in the aftermath of the fall. You remember the promise that God gave to them? And then the act that God did in providing them coats of skins. And then remember the name that Adam gave to his wife. He called her Eve. And what was the significance of that? She is the mother of all living. Not the mother of all dying, the mother of all living. They were taking back hope then. In the birth of Seth, have you tonight given up your hope? Do you feel yourself tonight sinking in the grip of despair? Isn't it time for you, as it was for Adam and Eve, to go back to first principles, to go back to the promise of God and to reclaim your confidence in the direction of the Lord in your life? They were reclaiming hope, but they were doing something else. They were proclaiming faith. Eve spoke at the birth of her son. And she proclaimed her faith in the dealings of God with her. Notice what she said. She called his name Seth. For God, said she, hath appointed me another seed instead of Abel, whom Cain slew. Now, remember what she had said about Cain when he was born. I have gotten a man from the Lord. Literally, she felt she had gotten the promise. She had gotten the fulfillment of the promise. How quickly she was disabused of that notion. And then to have to see her godly son Abel lying dead at her brother's hand. She knew all that. But she knew that in Seth, she and Adam and all of the world had received a gift from God. As I said, Seth's name means appointed or appointment. And she said that she realized that here was God's replacement for Abel. The devil had tried to derail God's program, but he had not succeeded. Cain could kill Abel, but God would give them another son, appointed to replace Abel. Eve must have mourned over Abel. She must have often reflected upon the fact that here was one in whom she had placed such expectation when she saw that he was going in the way of the truth, and then suddenly his life was cut off. But now comes the birth of Seth. And in the little face of that infant Seth, she saw the hand of God. And she realized that the promise of God had never been overthrown. It had never been derailed. She could go back to those words in chapter 3 and verse 15 to which I was just referring, where the Lord said, I will put enmity between thee, between the serpent and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. The prophecy of the coming of the Redeemer. She could go back to that. And what was she saying when Seth was born? Here is the reinforcement of the truth that what God promised back there in the Garden of Eden before we had to leave it, what God promised is going to come to pass. That seed. Striking, isn't it, that she used that term? God has appointed me another seed instead of Abel, whom Cain slew. Here was her confidence. Here was her proclamation of faith that that promised seed would come. That the Redeemer would enter the world. That He would accomplish redemption. That He would go to the cross. That He would make the sacrifice. That was her faith. That was what Adam believed. That was what Adam preached. And that was what Seth was taught. And that is what he came to preach. And that's what he taught his son Enos. And that's what Enos taught his son. And so on, all the way down to Noah. From generation to generation, what were they proclaiming? Their faith in that which God had revealed. Here's the great challenge to the people of God today. How do you go on believing when there is so much disaster, not only physically but morally, all around you? How do you go on believing? Well, the fact is now Christ has come. The Redeemer has come. He has gone to the cross. He has prevailed there over the devil. He has smashed the serpent's head. And He's going to come again. So here is the great challenge today. Do you believe that the Redeemer is going to come again as He promised that He would? Do you believe that? That is how we keep hope alive. That is how we stir up our faith. We look to that promise, the Lord will come. It's time for us to depend then again on that which the Lord has said. We read here that Eve's faith led her and Adam to proclaim that faith to their young son. For in the next generation, a singular thing happened. And that's the third thing we find in our text. The third action they were doing, they were affirming truth. Seth grew up. All those details are passed over in silence. We're not told anything about them. But we read at the beginning of verse 26 that to Seth, to him also there was born a son. He grew up. He got married. And he and his wife had a son. Now how do I know all that? Because Adam and Eve were married. And they had Seth. So that was Seth's model. Not the model of Lamech, the descendant of Cain. But the model of Adam and Eve. And he and his wife called the name of their son Enos, or Enosh as it is in the Hebrew. And we read in verse 26 that it was then, during the lifetime of Enos, that men began to call on the name of the Lord. And again we say that that was not a statement that had never happened before. But what it was saying was that now there was a more organized, more corporate form of this calling on the name of the Lord. The worship of the true God began to become more widespread as there were more descendants of Adam and Eve. Through Seth, in this faithful line, there were more and more people who would come together to worship the Lord, to call upon the name of the Lord. And they asserted that their worship was ascribed, it was given to the one whose name is Jehovah. In his commentary on Genesis, Calvin put it very vividly when he wrote, "Yea, this is the spiritual worship of God which faith produces. This is particularly worthy of notice, because Satan contrives nothing with greater care than to adulterate with every possible corruption the pure invocation of God, or to draw us away from the only God to the invocation of creatures. Even from the beginning of the world, he has not ceased to move this stone, that miserable men might weary themselves in vain in a preposterous worship of God. He's hit it right on the head. And that's what was going on all around Seth and his descendants. People were running after the images of creatures. But what we find here in verse 26, that here was worship that was directed to the true and living God. This was the truth that formed the basis of worship. You hear so much today about worship. It's practically a cottage industry. So many things about how do we worship, you know, what a methodology. And worship today is all about methodology. It has nothing to do with truth. In fact, truth is kept as far out of it as possible, because it just might upset some of the methodology. But here was worship that was directed to the true and living God, not to somebody's imagination of God, not to somebody's image of God, but to the true and living God as He had revealed Himself. It was worship that was offered on the proper basis, the blood of the sacrifice. And here's the thing. It was maintained in the face of all the apostate forms of religion that already existed in the world. The way of Cain. Cain founded that way. And you can be sure that through the generations, all sorts of variations on that way of Cain began to appear. But at the end of the day, it was all the same way of Cain. All the same apostasy. And here Seth and those who came after him, they had to maintain this way of true worship in the face of that. When others were saying, oh, come on, that's so old-fashioned. Nobody does that anymore. And those are words that you hear all the time today. What? You mean you don't have all kinds of screens set up to flash images on while the people are worshiping? You mean you don't have the people rolling around? You don't have them doing the wave and all that kind of thing during worship? What kind of antiques are you? We are in the face of apostate religion all around us. And like Seth and his descendants, we have got to affirm the truth. We have got to maintain the truth. Is it popular? No. It wasn't popular in Seth's day. How do you suppose it got to the point where in Noah's day there were only 8 people who ended up on the ark? How do you suppose it got to that point? It wasn't popular. Noah couldn't influence anybody. He preached for 120 years while the ark was being built, and people thought he was crazy. And that's the way people think today. Here were people who were set for the worship of God. And that is still the answer to the degeneracy of the world in our time. Goal for a people who are godly in their approach to life. Let us devote ourselves then to the true worship of God, and let us refuse to give up the truth that God has revealed. Let us defend it, if necessary, with our lives. Many of our Protestant ancestors did that. Earlier this year, some of the folks that were in Belfast for the Free Presbyterian International Congress went over to Scotland afterward. They spent a few days traveling around, and I got to see some of the pictures that some of them took, hear the reports. They went to the place where the two Margarets were put to death in covenanting times. An older woman and a young woman. They wouldn't deny Christ. They wouldn't subscribe to the king's religion. And so they were sentenced to be tied to stakes when the tide was out, just off the coast. And then, as the hours passed, the tide came in, and the water rose higher and higher. And as this was going on all the time, the people saying, "Won't you subscribe to now to the king's way of worship?" And they remained resolute, singing to the end, till the tide rose above their heads and they were drowned. When I think of their example and the example of so many others, may God have mercy upon me if I ever give up the truth for a mess of popularity. We have to give the truth up in order to have a large group of people. We don't want it. We'd rather have the truth. And that was what Seth and his line resolved. And they transmitted it to those who came after them. And that's what we must do. We are here to transmit to those in the next generation and in the next generation. Some of us, and I can include myself in that number now, some of us have grandchildren. I don't think anybody has a great-grandchild yet. Some do. I'm getting the high sign that some do. But when you come to that, you think of the generations to follow. You don't always have an influence when the generations become remote, but you have an influence on the generation that is at hand. Let us seek to transmit it to those who are following us, whether in our own families or in the families of those around us. This is the truth. Godliness in the midst of degeneracy. It's the best answer to all that is around us, to persevere in the way of Seth and to take our stand against the way of Cain.